KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
They offer really clear positions in a very complex political environment.
Political parties on the far right and the far left are becoming popular among young Europeans. For Saturday, March 15th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. The Trump administration has ordered information about soldiers of color and female veterans to be scrubbed from the Arlington National Cemetery's website. Also, the latest installment of Radio Diaries about one of the most popular preachers of the 20th century.
He's known as the Happy MI preacher. So he has this kind of charisma, smiling, very happy.
But that took a turn during the civil rights movement, plus Lady Gaga's return to pop music.
I think the fact that Lady Gaga has had such an experimental career and a such diverse catalog, it means that she can sort of pull this off.
First news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump says the U.S. conducted aerial attacks on Houthi rebels in Yemen. The move comes 11 days after Trump reinstated their designation as a foreign terrorist organization. The Iran-backed group has attacked boats in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden since the start of the Israel-Hamas war in 2023. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more.
Trump said in a social media post, quote, "We will use overwhelming lethal force until we have achieved our objective." He also wrote that Iran's support of the Houthis must end immediately, or the U.S., quote, "will hold you fully accountable and we won't be nice about it." 3 days ago, the Houthis declared they would target Israeli vessels in the waterways around their country at a time when Israel has been blocking aid to Gaza. Houthis have also targeted merchant ships and U.S. military vessels in those waters. In November, the U.S. stopped an attempted attack on two warships. As a result of attacks on ships, former President Joe Biden also launched airstrikes on Houthis during his presidency. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, West Palm Beach, Florida.
The Trump administration is gutting Voice of America and other international networks funded by the U.S. government. NPR's David Folkenflik reports it follows a decree by President Trump to eliminate all activity there not required by law.
Journalists found themselves locked out of their studios Saturday morning. Within a few hours, more than 1,000 journalists at Voice of America were told they were on immediate, indefinite paid leave. Similar moves would strip its sister networks of all federal funding, including Radio Free Asia and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. These networks were set up first in World War II and the Cold War to offer uncensored news that also modeled American democracy, including bad news and dissent from official positions. Trump officials took aim at Voice of America at the end of his first term. Some of their actions were later found to be abuses of power. It's unclear whether there will be legal challenges this time. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
After tornadoes overnight left at least 18 people dead in Missouri, Arkansas, and Texas, several tornadoes touched down in parts of the Deep South today. Matt Bloom with member station WWNO in New Orleans has more.
First responders say tornadoes have destroyed dozens of homes across the region. Power lines are down for thousands, and the search for survivors is underway. In the town of East Fork, Louisiana, a large tornado destroyed over 24 homes. Sheriff Gerald Sticker says deputies rescued a woman from her house.
There was an individual that they did remove from the residence. An individual, as I understand it, was not injured. However, they were stranded, and we got them to a safe, dry location.
Officials in Mississippi have reported at least 30,000 people have lost electricity. The powerful storms are expected to cause more damage as they move east. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Idaho will become the first state in the U.S. to prefer execution by firing squad, thanks to a new law signed this week. As Troy Oppie of Boise State Public Radio reports, the law will take effect next year to allow the state to renovate its execution facility.
State lawmakers approved the firing squad as a backup option in 2023, following the failure of several lethal injection execution attempts. Republican State Senator Brian Lenny says it's a more reliable way to carry out capital punishment.
With a 30 cal rifle bullet traveling somewhere around 3,000 FPS, the death is instantaneous. And in this case, I think it's an act of mercy.
Four other states have death by firing squad as an option. None makes it the first choice. Idaho currently has 9 inmates on death row and a capital trial scheduled this summer for the man accused of killing 4 University of Idaho students in late 2022. For NPR News, I'm Troy Oppie in Boise.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he's expelling the new ambassador from South Africa, accusing Ibrahim Rasool of being anti-white, anti-American, and hating President Trump. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said in a statement today that the decision to expel Rasool was regrettable. This follows a series of criticisms from Trump against the South African government, including an executive order last month denouncing new laws that created a program for the expropriation of unused agricultural land that white owners refused to sell to black people. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from USPS. USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz in for Scott Detrow. President Trump has ordered the United States military to launch strikes against Houthi targets in Yemen. Trump says the Houthis are funded by Iran and have regularly fired missiles at U.S. troops and allies. NPR's Tom Bowman is here. Tom, what do we know about these apparent strikes?
Well, Rob, I'm told by 2 U.S. officials not authorized to speak that this is an ongoing operation and more sustained than what we've seen in the past, both sea and air attacks against Houthi drone and radar sites. And I'm told these strikes will last days, if not weeks.
You know, I'm going to pivot here, Tom, because you're also reporting on information about decorated black soldiers, among others, that has been scrubbed from the Arlington National Cemetery's website, apparently to comply with a Trump administration order. What's missing here?
Well, they took down internal links that you could go to and use to go to the web pages that listed dozens of notable graves of black, Hispanic, and female veterans and their spouses. Now, these pages included short biographies of people like General Colin Powell, the first black chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Hector Santa Anna, a World War II pilot who later took part in the Berlin airlift, and also an all-black, all-female postal unit from World War II. These changes were first noted by historian Kevin Levin on his Substack. It's called Civil War Memory. And all this was confirmed to NPR by an Army official.
And were all the history and stories behind these veterans removed as well?
Well, no, not removed, but just more difficult to find. And again, not prominently noted on the website. You can still find them through other links such as U.S. Supreme Court or prominent military officials, so not as obvious. Now, Pentagon officials have been directed by the President and Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth to get rid of all content at the Pentagon that relates to diversity, equity, inclusion programs.
So as we understand this, this is like easy access to the histories of veterans who fought in U.S. wars from diverse backgrounds, and that's part of this.
Yeah, that's right. And just one part of all this, at a Pentagon town hall meeting last month, Hegseth criticized past celebrations of diversity, saying the term diversity is our strength is, quote, the dumbest phrase in military history. He put out a memo saying identity months are dead at DOD. He said the Pentagon would no longer host celebrations or events related to Black History Month, Women's History Month, National Hispanic Heritage Month, or National Disability Employment Awareness Month. He went on to say, Rob, that such events put one group ahead of another and erode camaraderie. And he said unity and purpose are what's important to the warfighting mission.
So, Tom, what else has Secretary Hegseth done here?
Well, Hegseth also instructed the Pentagon to remove any news and feature articles, photos, videos that promote DEI. And the time frame for that ran through all 4 years of the Biden administration. Now, this has all led to some confusion. I spoke with a Pentagon employee who's involved with social media posting, and he and his colleagues wondered, you know, Can we even mention Martin Luther King Day since it's a federal holiday?
Right.
And he suggested all of this could have an impact on recruiting, which the services, of course, have struggled with. You know, right now, the proportion of black women recruits in the Army is higher than their number in the civilian workforce. So what message does it send if you're getting rid of these celebrations or not highlighting prominent people buried at Arlington like Colin Powell?
And this effort by the Pentagon has expanded across the military, right?
No, that's correct. You know, West Point has banned clubs such as the Korean-American Relations Seminar. The Naval Academy has cut or restructured two political science courses that focused on gender. So, and I'm told professors there are nervous, scouring their writings for anything that might mention diversity could get them in trouble.
That's NPR's Tom Bowman. I am usually in Berlin covering Germany and Central Europe, and one story that recently caught my eye came out of Germany's national election a few weeks ago. I like to look at demographics after an election, and in this one, something really stood out. Nearly half of all German voters between the ages of 18 and 24 cast their ballots for one of two parties, the party on the far right of Germany's political spectrum and the one on the far left of it. And Germany's not alone. Young people throughout Europe are doing the same. So why is this happening? My colleague Esme Nicholson and I tried to find out. Tens of thousands of people marched through the streets of Berlin on International Women's Day. Many of them young women like 24-year-old Elina Wuttke. I feel that society is becoming more and more polarized, says Wuttke. You can see it in the election results, whether it's between young and old or men and women. It's all divided. Wuttke reflects this division, too. She was among 35% of women between the age of 18 and 24 who voted for the far-left Die Linke Party, a party that has its roots in the Cold War-era East German Communist Party, a party that advocates for a socialist state, aims to root out capitalism, and is staunchly anti-military. Fellow marcher Cecilia Badlowski voted for the party, too.
Unter anderem aber auch einfach für soziale Gerechtigkeit. Das ist natürlich auch ein großer Punkt der Linken.
I voted for them because they demand the super rich be taxed at the same level as the average earner, says Bartlewski. They're also supportive of women and they fight against policies made to benefit rich white cis men. And while young German women voted in droves for the far left, more than a quarter of young German men voted for the far right Alternative for Germany, or AfD party. A party whose members rail against immigrants, repeat Nazi slogans, and support Russia in its war in Ukraine. Political communication strategist Johannes Hillier says these results seem baffling, but he thinks he knows why both German men and women are heading to parties on the political extremes.
And this is first because they offer really clear positions in a very complex political environment. Second, they are seen as anti-elite, and especially the youth has been pretty upset with the political elite in the past years.
But Hillier says perhaps the most important reason for young voters heading to the extremes are the devices they are holding in their hands.
Both parties are pretty successful on social media. Both parties are actually the front runners when it comes to reach on TikTok especially, but also on other channels.
The far-right AfD has excelled at using social media to spread its message, says Hillier.
Echte Männer sind rechts. Echte Männer haben Ideale. Echte Männer sind Patrioten. Dann klappt's auch mit der Freundin.
A viral social media post shows AfD politician Maximilian Krah saying, real men are right-wing. Real men have ideals. Real men are patriots. That, says Krah, is how to get a girlfriend. And then there's German right-wing social media influencer phenom Naomi Zeibt.
I am proud to be German, and it's okay to be proud to be German.
Zeip's posts, many in English, have had a far-reaching influence, extending to a key advisor inside the White House.
It's okay to be proud to be German. This is a very important principle.
That's Elon Musk reciting word for word one of 24-year-old Naomi Zeip's popular social media posts to an AfD rally last year. Zeipt has been nicknamed the Musk Whisperer for her influence on the Tesla founder, and comm strategist Hillier says her influence, due to her English posts, have made waves across the Atlantic.
Naomi Zeipt is building a bridge between the far right in the US and the far right in Germany, and she became, I would say, a translator of German politics for Elon Musk, because she was posting in English using AfD narratives.
Hilias says traditional German political discourse lacks emotion, but the messaging from both the far right and the far left over social media is full of emotion. So much, he says, that it's become manipulative. It's a style, he thinks, that is turning politics in Germany and throughout Europe into entertainment rather than how to effectively run a government. NPR producer Esme Nicholson brought us that reporting from Berlin. Last year, Salt Lake City won the bid to host the Winter Olympics in 2034. Now state leaders are trying to have electric air taxis, yes, air taxis, operating in time for the Games. KUER's Caroline Ballard reports.
The small white Alia aircraft buzzes down the runway and lifts into the sky above Utah's snow-capped mountains. It looks similar to any other small plane overhead. It's designed to carry up to 5 passengers, and it is entirely electric. Emma Davis, a flight test engineer at Vermont-based aerospace company Beta Technologies that makes the Alia, really enjoys flying in them.
So the coolest thing about this aircraft is the view. You'll notice that the windscreen is basically uninterrupted. It's just, it's beautiful, it's breathtaking, and it's exciting just to be able to fly in a piece of, you know, future history.
Back in October, the Federal Aviation Administration recognized electric air taxis as a new type of aircraft, joining helicopters and airplanes. It also outlined training and regulations for pilots to fly them. But there's still a long process before air taxi companies can start operating. State Senator Wayne Harper has worked for years to clear the way for that to happen in Utah. He says companies have told him there are no remaining barriers from the state.
All the companies say, nope, the barriers are out of the way. The only challenge we have is make sure we get FAA certification and we can have airspace that we can fly in.
But with all the policy changes under the Trump administration, there's no firm timeline for when licensed air taxi pilots will take to the skies. On Monday, the FAA said it would temporarily suspend its new air taxi rule while the administration reviews it. Still, Matthew Moss, the Utah Department of Transportation's director of aeronautics, is confident an Uber-in-the-sky type service will be available in time for the 2034 Olympics. But he says it might not look like science fiction just yet.
You know, you think of Blade Runner or something futuristic, you know, Star Wars, all these vehicles that are flying in the sky. 100 years, 200 years, maybe it'll look like that, but it's not going to be anything like that in the near term.
Beta Technologies and Utah's Aerospace and Defense Trade Group are showing off the Alia aircraft at Utah airports this week. For NPR News, I'm Caroline Ballard in Salt Lake City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The U.S. has launched what President Trump says is a decisive and powerful attack on Iranian-backed Houthi militants in Yemen in retaliation for months of attacks by the rebels on maritime traffic, including commercial ships as well as American warships in the Red Sea. The death toll is rising after severe weather, including tornadoes, swept the central and southeast southeastern U.S. overnight. Officials now say more than a dozen people have died in Arkansas and Missouri. Storms continue today with tornado warnings and watches out for parts of several states in the southeast. And Arlington National Cemetery is removing from its website sections highlighting prominent Black, Hispanic, and female veterans to comply with a directive from President Trump to remove all articles that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Today we're bringing you another installment of Radio Diary series Making Waves about influential and controversial broadcasters. In 1934, the Washington Post called Elder Lightfoot Solomon Mishaw the best-known Black man in America. Known as the Happy Am I Preacher, Mishaw's Sunday services were broadcast to more than 25 million listeners on CBS Radio. But when the Civil Rights Movement came around, Mishaw's popularity took a turn.
Good morning from the nation's capital. From the Church of God in Washington, D.C., we bring you now its regular Sunday morning service conducted by Elder Lightfoot Solomon Mishaw.
When I was a little boy, and my father took me to the church. There were so many people in there, there was no seats.
You see the band, the choir, and then you see him waltz into the church and jump up on the pulpit, and then the choir starts singing, Happy Am I. Then he would begin his sermon. And even as a child, you knew to be still and to listen.
Good morning, is everybody happy? This is Elder Lightfoot Solomon Mishaw, the Happy Mind Preacher. Come this morning to tell you, Jesus loves you.
My name is Joseph Sturdivant, and I've been a member of the Church of God since birth, 1933, and I'm still there.
My name is Lillian Ashcraft Eason. I was born into the Church of God in 1940. There were other good preachers, but the Church of God made you feel special. People in the church thought that they could go to him with any problem that were bothering them within their lives. There was the Great Depression, for example. And a lot of people came to the church because they were hungry.
Well, the Happy Am I Cafe was down on 7th Street. You could get a meal for 1 cent. And the interesting thing about that cafe was that we fed a lot of white people. He was always looking to do things that other preachers wouldn't do.
Your friends, your associates were all members of the Church of God. That was your family. Elder Mishaw was like your father.
I'm not much of a singer, but I thank God for my song. I'm on my way rejoicing. I'm happy all day long.
He's known as the Happy Am I Preacher. So he has this kind of charisma, smiling, very happy. My name is Dr. Lerone Martin. And I am the director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. He knows how to put people at ease, how to make people laugh.
When the load get heavy and the way seems dreary, I just keep on singing my song, Happy Am I.
There were many who ridiculed him. One detractor called it a religious version of Amos and Andy. But he also had a great deal of supporters.
Sometimes you would have busloads of people, white people, that would come from different cities just for that broadcast. It was unusual to have something like that going on.
Ain't no white, no black, brown, no yellow, no red with God. I said, I'd die for a white man as quick as I would for a black man. God's grace is for every human race.
Mashal is someone I think that we can point to as a radio genius in the sense that he's able to do something that most of us could not imagine by having a nationwide broadcast that is extremely popular with both black and white listeners. And this is an African-American man in the early 30s.
He decides to support Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his first election to the White House and go on the radio and encourage African-Americans to vote, then really brings in a lot of votes for him. I'm Suzanne Smith. I'm a professor of history at George Mason University, and I'm currently working on my book project on Elder Lightfoot Solomon Mashal. Once he develops that relationship with Roosevelt, Truman and Eisenhower also see him in a similar vein. The presidents see him as someone who is a national voice that African Americans listen to, that if he endorses them in any way in his broadcasts, it will get African Americans to vote for them.
He ingratiates himself with these presidents in many ways by flattery. He writes to Truman and he says, you're God's man. And in fact, look at your name. Your name says true man, because you are a true man. He is a constant figure in the White House, even if he's being brought to the White House under the cover of darkness.
Generally, black people didn't go in the White House. My father-in-law was his chauffeur at one time, and he said he would take him to the White House, but they would usually go there about 2 o'clock in the morning when nobody could see him going in there. Whoever heard anybody doing anything like that.
He's very much a wheeler dealer.
He sincerely believes that having insider status is what's going to help people of color the most. Not protesting power, but trying to work with power.
Upon the shoulders of John Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI since 1924, rest heavy responsibilities. Not only must he direct the Bureau's offensive against subversive agents...
He knew how to find favor with white people. That was his strategy throughout his life for trying to uplift his race. In the 1940s, he starts communicating with J. Edgar Hoover, and J. Edgar Hoover was tremendously revered by most Americans. They felt he was somebody who was fighting crime in America and fighting communism in America and doing a good job.
Mashal says that I'm a Christian, I know that the FBI is a Christian organization, and together we can make sure that communism doesn't get a foothold in this country.
Hoover is trying to cultivate his relationships with religious leaders to shore up support for his own investigative missions and his general power in the government.
Their relationship heats up after King's I Have a Dream address at the March on Washington in August of 1903.
Even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream.
Hoover's concerned about this. He believes that there is a communist conspiracy at root within the civil rights movement, and particularly with Martin Luther King Jr. That's the moment where the FBI is plotting and thinking that Mashal may be useful. They will call Mashal into service. Anytime they need someone to launder information for them, they'll call in Mashal, and he'll do so on his radio broadcast.
Don't worry about him. In Alabama or anywhere else, all of us are going to die.
But what we want to do is be sure when we do die, we got a home in the sky.
Mashal is saying all this protest, all this nonsense, all this jostling for rights is absurd.
And don't let malice or envy, don't let the newspapers nor the radios stir you up. Just get on your knees and pray for them. Amen.
He goes about saying that racial equality is a worthy thing to pursue, but it's never going to materialize until God establishes his rule in people's hearts. Martin Luther King's dream is just silly. I do think Mashal sees King's rise in some ways as a threat. Not only is King rising to power, but he's getting recognition. At the end of 1963, he's informed by Time magazine that he's the man of the year.
He was trying to hold on to his members, and he didn't want them over there in the civil rights movement. That was going to take them away from the church and maybe away from their membership. I remember feeling a conflict. There was a civil rights movement that was good. There was a Church of God that was good. So how do you live with those two forces?
When Martin Luther King made the speech, Elder Mitchell told us that that dream was not going to come true in this world. And he wasn't against Martin Luther King. He didn't say that. But the Lord's going to have to work that out. It was more than a man could do. And Elder Mitchell told us that that was the way it was going to be.
He becomes increasingly marginalized because he stood up against King.
He was still on CBS, but the popularity did decline.
Everything he had known in his life was being questioned when he was seeing a man like Martin Luther King, who was far more eloquent in many ways and far more confrontational.
You had entertainers of the day, popular entertainers of the day, who were coming out in support of civil rights. He didn't adjust. He stayed with the happy MI formula. And I think many of Americans at this time, especially Black Americans, began to not really enjoy the form. There are a number of letters to the editor in Black newspapers where people will criticize him and say, "What is he doing? I've enjoyed his preaching, but you do not publicly attack Martin Luther King Jr."
Up until the last few weeks of his life, he maintains his radio broadcasts, and you can hear it in his voice that he's really physically not well.
This morning, the world is standing in the need of prayer. Every man, every woman that knows that his hands are clean, heart pure.
He eventually suffers from a stroke and is hospitalized. He passed away quietly in the hospital in October of 1968.
If I go away, I'm coming back to receive you. All you've got to do is to keep on believing.
People often don't want to acknowledge that he had such a popular following because his politics now, in retrospect, were on the wrong side of history.
I think he's sort of forgotten. I wanted him to become more of an associate of Dr. King's, but I think that I understand that there are no perfect people.
There's only one Elder Mitchell. We just try to live according to the gospel that he preached. What he taught us is still true. He's not here, but the gospel is still here.
The Church of God still stands on Georgia Avenue in Washington, D.C. The congregation is much smaller now, and many of the worshipers are elderly, but Elder Mashaw's sermons are still published monthly in the church bulletin. The story you heard was produced by Micah Hazel and edited by Deborah George. You can hear more stories from Making Waves on the Radio Diaries podcast. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This morning, journalists who showed up to work at the Voice of America broadcast network found themselves locked out and their jobs suspended indefinitely. More than 1,000 Voice of America journalists don't know if they're ever coming back to their jobs. Federal officials are also eliminating funding for other federally funded international broadcast networks. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now to talk about this. Hey, David.
Hey, Rob.
So, David, remind us a bit about the Voice of America and its sister networks. What do they do? What role do they play in international media?
So the Voice of America was set up in the heart of World War II, and the idea was to present news in occupied lands where you couldn't get reliable information. They presented news that was positive to the Allies that the Nazis weren't letting through, but also stuff where there were setbacks for the U.S. and their allies. The idea was you could trust this information. This then expanded to other networks which aren't owned by the federal government but are fully funded by it, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, also Radio Free Asia, and some others. And it's a form of soft diplomacy. That is, you're modeling what a free press looks like in a repressive state. You're also including dissent in that coverage to indicate that's part of a pluralistic society as well. And you're doing it in lands where you can't get news reliably from a free press or where they're not viable enough to operate.
I used to listen to it as a young journalist in China. You know, it sounds like this has had a big impact. What exactly has happened to VOA and how do we know this?
So what we know is that basically it appears that all full-time employees, the Voice of America, right up to the director, have been put on this indefinite paid leave. And they've been told, turn in your badges, turn in your equipment, your records, and we'll let you know what's next. Wow. And this appears to follow the track of some things that had happened to State Departments, for example, in foreign aid programs, where a lot of them were ultimately shuttered. You've also seen that in these other networks, such as Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, the federal government has said, we're not going to be providing you with any more funds, even though we had these contracts to provide you this congressionally allocated amount of money to do so in these grants. They're saying, no mas. It's the president made this order on Friday night saying we're going to eliminate unnecessary activities at the parent agency of these networks. And this is the consequence of that. We know this, not that the U.S. Agency for Global Media is commenting, because I've talked to 15 people at Voice of America and the agency and a few who have recently departed and reviewed all the memos involved. And so it really looks like they're attempting to gut these things entirely or bring them to heel.
So, David, I'm trying to get a handle on what this means for the listenership of VOA and its affiliates. How many people listen to VOA worldwide?
So the U.S. Agency for Global Media says that these networks together have an unduplicated weekly audience of 420 million people in 63 languages, and that's in more than 100 countries across the globe each week. It's pretty Wow. extraordinary when you think of it, right? But, you know, these are reports about things that happen in lands ruled by autocrats and dictators. It has vexed some folks who have warm ties with President Trump, people like Vladimir Putin, Viktor Orban. And that's been a source of contention for Trump. But also the very fact that you have taxpayer dollars going to networks that are trying to model what an independent press looks like doesn't go over well at the White House. You're seeing either an effort to gut these broadcasters entirely or to erase their journalistic independence.
NPR's David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
This is NPR News.
Raphael Cormack says people were first drawn to the occult because they sought hope in the unseen. Sound familiar?
The wellness gurus, they also represent something that we want to be true, that if we eat well and think positive thoughts, everything's going to be okay.
Raphael Cormack on his book, Holy Men of the Electromagnetic Age, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump signed an executive order dismantling seven agencies, including the parent of Voice of America. Full-time workers at VOA were put on administrative leave with pay today. The media outlet is designed to provide unbiased news to audiences around the world, but Trump has criticized its editorial decisions since his first term. The death toll from tornadoes overnight is rising. There are at least 18 storm-related deaths across three states, along with eight people who died in Kansas in a dust storm. Damage is extensive. Storms today are targeting the Deep South. The National Weather Service has issued tornado watches and warnings for parts of several states. And the replacement astronauts for the two who have been stuck at the International Space Station for the past 9 months are expected to arrive late tonight. They blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center last night. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Never in American history has it been so easy to gamble legally, from casinos to online poker and sports betting. All of that was made possible by state lotteries. Scratch and Win is a new GBH News podcast about how a bunch of Massachusetts state bureaucrats set out to beat the mob at its own game, and ended up creating a $100 billion obsession. Host Ian Koss joins me now to talk about it. Hey, Ian.
So good to be here.
So the show opens with you visiting a convenience store near Boston where you live and talking to a lottery player.
So what are you playing right now?
I play $50 every day.
Have you won yet?
Right there. So far, I already spent $300 on the bucket. There's nothing.
What this man is playing is the state's brand new $50 scratch ticket. He points at the serial number on the top right corner to show he's keeping track. This is ticket number 7 for today.
This is the number 7.
The other 6 are in the trash bucket already. 6 $50 tickets.
Oh, wow. I keep going until I'm broke.
So why do you keep playing?
I'm dreaming to get that big one. Yeah. So I can retire. I'm 75 years old. Yeah. I don't have money in retirement. Too late to start now because I already spent so much money. So maybe this one, but end up getting broke and broke.
This man is happy to talk money. A couple times he opens up his wallet and shows me exactly how much he has left, how much he's spent. But he doesn't want to say much about himself, including his name. I know that he lives nearby and that he works as a mechanic, which fits with the dark blue work pants and black T-shirt. He comes in here on his lunch break, part of his daily routine.
Yesterday I had 1,500. Count that. Only about 900 left. 600 already out. If the wife find out...
He looks at me and draws a hand across his throat.
You're dead?
Done.
Wow. 75 years old, no money in retirement, and a very last-ditch effort to bank on the lottery. That is pretty stark. You know, Ian, how did you wind up in that convenience store talking to lottery players like this man?
So this started for me when I came across these sales figures for state lotteries, so every state that runs a lottery, which is most of them, reports data on revenue. And I came across these stats, and there was something very stark about them, which is that Massachusetts, where I live, is kind of an outlier state. In most states, the maybe average adult spends a few hundred dollars per year on lottery tickets. In Massachusetts, if you average out all the sales over the adult population, it is over $1,000 per adult. And that number, one thing, it just felt high.
Right.
Especially when you factor in there are probably a few zeros, many zeros averaged into that number. And it also just felt weird. Like, why Massachusetts of all places? And that kind of got me started on this question of how did state lotteries get started and how do these things operate?
Okay, so let's dig into this a little more. Tell me a little bit more about the history of the Massachusetts lottery. How did it begin and how did it become so wildly successful and sell so many tickets?
Sure. So Massachusetts was one of the first generation of lottery states, along with New Jersey, New York, New Hampshire. And if you notice, all those states I'm listing are in the Northeast.
Right.
That is really where the lottery phenomenon starts. It starts in these sort of, deindustrializing, heavily Catholic, actually, states where there was a need for new sources of revenue. And there was also a population that was relatively tolerant of gambling. And so you get the Massachusetts lottery. It starts in 1973. And it's not all that successful right out of the gate. They're doing, at the time, the most common game was basically a weekly drawing. And the sales, there's a little burst of excitement when it starts, but pretty quickly sales go flat. And the lottery starts looking for ways to innovate. And one of the first big innovations the state makes, and really what sets kind of the tone for everything that follows, is that Massachusetts becomes the first state to try an instant ticket, what we would normally call a scratch ticket, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is where the lottery's fates really begin to change. And the scratch ticket becomes ultimately the most successful and important game to basically all state lotteries.
Now, you went back and looked at the history of the lottery. We just talked a little bit about that for the Massachusetts State Lottery, but the mob was also involved in this business. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So in addition to raising money for the state, the other key rationale, and this was really important politically, actually, in getting these lotteries created, was to put the mob out of business. So if we go back to the 1960s, 70s, when the lotteries are getting started, it's not like there were no lotteries. There were just lotteries run by the mafia. So you had what was called the numbers game, which was very popular, especially in sort of northern and East Coast American cities, New York, Detroit, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston. And these were huge, huge businesses for the mob. So the state, it in many ways, it's a lot like drug policy later, where it's like, well, the demand is strong. It doesn't seem like we can put this out of business entirely. Maybe we ought to simply legalize it and bring it in-house. And hey, we can make some money from it while we're at it.
Why don't we make that money? So at one point, you interviewed a notorious former mobster named Kevin Weeks about the state lottery, and he puts it pretty simply.
It's the same old story. The government sees money to be made, they get involved in it. We'll just put everybody else out of business. That's what they did. Mm-hmm. They're the biggest gang in the country.
The biggest gang in the country. Is that why states got into the gambling business in the first place? It just came down to how much money they could make?
I think, when you look at the politics across those early lottery states, the key driving force is revenue. It seems clear to me that the stuff about putting the mob out of business was very important rhetorically, but really the driving factor was revenue. This was a time where, states were really hurting for money. And at the same time, there was a lot of resistance to increased taxes. The 70s, and this is maybe even more true going into the 80s and 90s, nobody wanted to raise taxes. In fact, the very first state to create a lottery was New Hampshire, which is famously tax averse, right? There is no income tax in New Hampshire. And so the lottery was seen as an alternative, another way to raise money that was more popular at the time.
So, Ian, you know, how does all of this connect with the kind of gambling that we're seeing today? You know, casinos, online poker. I feel like when I watch football, for example, every other commercial is a sports betting commercial. I mean, it's basically anything goes at this point.
Yeah, the way I see it, lotteries really did kind of the slow cultural work of normalizing gambling and making everything that we see today possible. I think it's easy to forget that if you go back to 1960, there were no casinos outside of the state of Nevada. There were no casinos in Atlantic City, right? There were no state lotteries, and there was, of course, no widespread legal sports betting. So we've seen in the span of a couple generations just a radical transformation in the way our country gambles. And if you think about lotteries and the power of taking this thing that had been vice, right, that had been really in the shadows and margins of society, and putting the state's stamp on it, right, putting it at the corner convenience store, putting it on television, that did so much to kind of to bring gambling out in the open and also to whet the state's appetite. You know, once they realized that there was this gambling revenue as possible, then it was very logical for the states to then start looking at casinos and to then start looking at sports betting. And really everything we've seen since flows from that same logic.
Ian Koss is the host of the new GBH News podcast, Scratch and Win. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
You might know Lady Gaga for being a pop star. But in the last decade, she's done a lot more than just make radio-friendly hits. She's had leading roles in films and television, taken a country turn and recorded two jazz albums with the late Tony Bennett. But last week, Lady Gaga returned to pop music when she released Mayhem. Critics are calling the album a return to form for an artist who loves to experiment. We're joined by NPR Music's Hazel Sills to talk about Mayhem. Welcome, Hazel.
Thank you for having me.
So this is the first album that we've heard from Lady Gaga since 2020. What do you think of it?
I think that this album, Mayhem, is really Gaga doing what she does best. I mean, she's making this very like dark, theatrical pop music. She was also very inspired by goth music making this album, which is interesting, referencing bands like Nine Inch Nails and The Cure. Oh. There are all these songs about, you know, beasts and zombies and witchcraft. there's even a song called Abracadabra that actually credits the very influential 80s goth rock group Siouxsie and the Banshees, because it sounds quite similar to one of the band songs.
So Lady Gaga is a pop artist, but she's also made music in other genres. And you know, as we mentioned, she made jazz albums with Tony Bennett. She took a country turn. How does this album fit into that career?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Gaga has called this album very chaotic. In my opinion, it really isn't chaotic. I feel like Mayhem is her kind of returning to the sound that launched her career back in the late 2000s. And it sounds like she's often performing almost like an homage to her best work on this album. There's like multiple parts on the album where it feels like she's very explicitly referencing her own catalog. For example, there's a song called Garden of Eden. The way that she sings on that song, the way that she performs her vocals, it sounds so unbelievably similar to me to the way that she sings on her 2009 hit Bad Romance.
And you are saying that Mayhem is a return for Lady Gaga to the music she was making nearly two decades ago. Does the music sound, you know, dated at all, like this year in 2025?
I feel like I could see how people would think that, but it's funny to me, it really doesn't sound dated. You know, I feel like what's interesting about Mayhem is that I feel like a lot of artists could not pull off making an album like this, you know, sort of going back so explicitly to the sound of, you know, where they started their career. I feel like a lot of people would think that might be boring for an artist to do. I think the fact that Lady Gaga has had such an experimental career and a such diverse catalog, it means that she can sort of pull this off. And, you know, there's a song on the album called Vanish Into You. When I hear a song like that, I hear someone who really kind of knows their own personal formula and knows what works for them and is pulling it off quite confidently.
Yeah, I can hear that. I mean, this sounds like a lot like her earlier work. And as many of us know, you know, Lady Gaga is not just a musician. She just starred in the new Joker sequel, and she was nominated for an Oscar for her role in A Star Is Born. You know, how does her music fit into this career these days?
Yeah, I feel like from, you know, the outside, looking at Gaga's career over the last several years, it might be kind of confusing. She's just done so many different things, pivoted in so many different directions. And I feel like Mayhem, this album, is kind of a palate cleanser for anyone who has felt confused by that. She seems very aware of what people want from her, which is, you know, this kind of music. There's a song on the album called Perfect Celebrity where she's really kind of singing explicitly about how her fans see her and how Hollywood sees her. I'm made of plastic like a human doll. You push and pull me, I don't hurt at all. I talk in circles cause my brain it aches. You say I love you, I disintegrate. It just really solidifies to me that Mayhem is an album that is kind of serving as a reminder to everyone that underneath it all, she's kind of the same musician that she's always been.
So Hazel, what do you think Lady Gaga is trying to tell us with this album? Do you think it tells us something about how she sees herself as an artist?
Yeah, I think definitely. I've been describing this album to friends as sort of a flex. Like it just feels like her really confidently saying, you know, I'm in a world of my own. You know, she can make great pop music totally on her own terms. She doesn't have to follow trends. You know, she didn't need to do another dramatic pivot like so many pop stars have to do. And I think, you know, in between, you know, movies and television, all of her other ventures, she's basically saying like, I can always come back to this. Like I can do this in my sleep. And I think her fans, you know, really love her for it.
It must be nice. That's NPR Music's Hazel Sills. Hazel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For a Saturday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Thanks for listening. Have a great evening and tune in tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org. Thank you.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.